This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Tim and Sid.
I'm Tim McCall. Sid Sixero is the one shaking his head, which I can see across the television network and through Zoom. The reason why Sid Sixero is shaking his head at this 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 Pacific, on June 22nd, 2020, a tweet coming across the wire from Jesse Rogers and Jeff Passan, Jesse working for ESPN along with Jeff Passan. And I quote, "Sources tell Jeff Passan and I, players, have voted against the league's latest proposal to play 60 games. The vote was 33-5 against."
Is there a sound effect you think would fit here, Tim? I feel like a sound effect would fit in some way, shape, or form. Forgive me for putting you on the spot. That works.
Oh,
that works.
Tastes like a fart.
Also, option two is good. Option two is strong.
Don't ask me about that again.
Well, we do a sports show, so I might have to ask him about this thing again. Sorry,
Kevin Durant. How about this?
Anything's possible.
Can we get positive on this?
If we were to get, I'm not going to shut it down, Tim. If we were to get positive, what is your first angle on a down 33-5 vote among a players union that has rarely been unified? Rarely. But it seems to be unified. Where would you go first on the positive take?
That might be the toughest question that you've ever asked me on this show. Maybe that Rob Manfred will just impose a season and we'll get baseball of some sort this year, though it probably won't be anything that we want to see, because like we're seeing in basketball right now, although it's only two, people will just opt out of this.
Yeah, Davis Bertans of the Washington Wizards, and as we've been on air, Trevor Ariza of the Portland Trailblazers have both said they are not going to play for separate reasons.
Yeah, for completely different reasons.
Yeah, Trevor Ariza is more. He has custody for a month of his son. He's been in a legal battle for custody. It's a little different situation than Bertans in Washington, who's a 27-year-old about to become a free agent, having a career.
I love
year.
How you're going. You're going down this road in the NBA because you don't want to talk about baseball.
Do you want to make a rule?
No, hold on.
It's not at all what I'm trying to do. But
do you want to make a rule where we don't talk about baseball?
No, I can't. We can't make that rule.
Why not?
Today, because this is actual news. This is actual stuff.
Not
that
today, Butch.
This is real stuff.
Okay, but how many people? Hold on. Hear me out on this. Right. How many people out there just want us to tell them, and you know what the answer is going to be on this, how many people out there just want us to tell them when Major League Baseball figures the bleep out?
90%, but I would argue today was a day where we saw them not figure it out. So we have some kind of, like you said earlier in the show, Tim, answer either way. What's it going to be? What's going to be, Botch? Where are you going, Major League Baseball? So I agree that people really don't want to hear this every day, but today something significant just, like, within the last few seconds, something significant just happened here.
Okay, so the news is that Rob Manfred is now expected to implement some sort of schedule. Now, the original thought was he would go 48, but that would allow the players to file their grievance, so the expected number is probably going to be 54 to 60 game schedule that would start no earlier than July 26th from various reports out there. So is that just the good news there, or will this be a fight tooth and nail until July 26th and we're going to have guys dropping out and not playing? Like, are we going to do this little dance in Major League Baseball for the next month and 4 days?
Well, we're going to do a dance whether it's labor or COVID-19 related anyway. Like, that dance is going to exist. Let's say they had nothing but peace, right? Nothing but peace, McAuliffe. Everything was rosy. Tony Clark and Rob Manfred had a press conference 6 weeks ago saying how great everything was. They've had 40 positive COVID tests within the last 7 days, and they haven't started camp. All spring training facilities have been shut down in Major League Baseball. So there's going to be a dance one way or another. Tim, Bob Nightingale just now of USA Today, several owners pleading with Commissioner Rob Manfred to go ahead and implement a season tonight. That would insinuate there are several who want what? They might not care at this point. I think that's a road that we need to really go down in this moment, because now it's in the owner's lap. Do you want Rob Manfred to do what I just read, or do you say bleep it? Do you say, considering what we saw last week, Tim, and what we may see this week with more testing, why play? Why? What are we doing this for? I think you're.
Yeah,
that's the conversation going on right now with ownership.
Just for them to lose money, for those who don't know.
Yeah.
Just for the owners to lose money. Now, there is the potential to make money depending on how the COVID numbers go. But for those who don't remember, what we talked about, I don't know, for the last couple of weeks, is that a bunch of numbers are spiking in a bunch of different places that figured this thing would just go away. And there were 40 positive COVID tests among players and staff in the last week. Creating a little more urgency and a little more fear in Major League Baseball's negotiations. So how much of this no vote is fear from the players that are worried about returning to play baseball and attempting to travel, which is the big difference between what basketball and hockey are trying to do and what baseball is attempting to do?
Baseball just don't look like they approach this properly in any way, shape, or form. Whether it's the health standpoint, whether it's the flying around from city to city standpoint, whether it's the financial standpoint, this has the makings, Tim. And they canceled the season, right? Let's remember, this is the same sport that wiped out 1994, as Expo fans will remember.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony Gwynn will remember going for 400. Nothing here has been handled properly. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And the 33-5 vote, Tim, that's the one that gets me. This union have a long history of not really being on the same page. And ownership has taken full advantage of it to the point where they've implemented essentially a soft cap. That's what they have. That luxury tax, when you go up the money in terms of what you get penalized, that is a soft cap. And it's led to the number of off seasons we've seen where, unless you're the top guys, you don't get it. You don't get paid. You don't get yours. And now we have a 33-5 vote with the season hanging in the balance. 33-5 with those 38 player reps on the call. 30 player rep per team plus the 8 in the executive committee. That unity is a clear indication of where this is going. And I sat here, Tim, forever talking to you about how I was positive and this is going to happen and blah, blah, blah.
You mushed it.
I mushed the whole thing up. We need a montage of how many times, honestly, we need a montage of how many times I said I feel good. I feel good about this. I feel strong that Major League Baseball aren't that stupid.
In the movie The Bronx Tale, where the term mush comes from, do they lock him back in the washroom or the cooler? Where was he?
I've never seen it, McCall. If you're talking, I've never seen A Bronx Tale. Is it good?
Go watch it.
Should I see it?
Yeah.
Should I see it?
Yeah, it's a good movie. Yeah, very good, especially considering what we're going through right now. For those who don't know, the players voted against the league's latest proposal, Major League Baseball, to play 60 games. Vote was 33-5 against. Maybe if my brain, which I am wont to do, searches for a positive in all of this. Bear this out with me, 6-0. If you're both sides in a labor disagreement, where in the end, you could just blame COVID-19 and the spike in case. I mean, Florida got over 4,000 cases on Saturday. They dropped all the way down to 3,400, actually 3,500 on Sunday. Hey, what'd they get today?
About 3,500.
Again?
It was about 3,500, yeah.
Okay, so Florida, with its population of 21.5 million, Canada yesterday had 318 cases, and we have 38 million people here. So there's just your little contract. If you're both sides and you could realistically blame COVID-19 for the inability to get back on the field, wouldn't you just agree to some sort of terms? And instead of having the whole world hate both the owners and the players for not getting this done, blame COVID-19. Like, okay, we wasted some time, but we got a deal done and we're ready to, oh, it's too bad. COVID-19 has gotten in the way, and for the safety of everybody, we're not going to play. Like, don't you think both sides could do a much better job PR-wise by just blaming it on this global pandemic than each other? Or is that, are they so far apart that they can't even get to that point? Because I think there's, maybe there's hope that baseball can actually get some games played here with some sort of agreement. Otherwise, they would just make the fake agreement PR-wise, use their brain and blame it on COVID-19 and say, we couldn't get it done.
But they're not smart enough to do that. It's the equivalent of you and me, Tim. We see a tsunami coming.
Okay? Why does this beauty school dropout in Toronto figure it out and they can't figure it out?
Well, first off, you are. Give yourself something because you're gorgeous. Stop with that. You are a beautiful man. It doesn't matter.
I think Greece. School dropout.
Yeah, that I saw. I didn't see Brock's tail. Beauty school dropout. They're not smart enough to do that, Tim. Like, we're here. They're not smart enough to do it. It's like you and I are chucking dice in the corner, and we see a tsunami coming. Mm-hmm. Instead of running from the tsunami, we're going to fight over the money. Would the smart play not be run from the tsunami and plan? Mm-hmm. But we're gonna scrap over $20-30, or bring it back to like our youth. We're playing hockey cards up against the wall, and I think I got your Pelly Lindbergh, and we scrap over that. Like they were fighting over the wrong thing. They were concerned about the wrong thing. It's a lot of money involved, but now you've lost that cover, just like you said, of there's a global pandemic. So maybe for everyone's safety, we don't play. No. That they can't cloak themselves in that anymore. That's gone. They can't go back to that. In my opinion, it's done. And we're going to find out tonight, Tim. Bill Shaken from the LA Times. I'm told to expect an announcement from MLB later tonight. And Bob Nightingale from USA Today. No indication the union will submit a counterproposal. And with a stalemate, it's in Manfred's hands. Well, it's in the owner's hands. Let's be accurate with that. Manfred's kind of a mouthpiece. He's an important man. But let's not let the owners of Major League Baseball off the hook here. So that's where we're at. And we'll find out more later tonight. Does he just implement a season? And how did the players react to that?
There isn't a tweet that I can read because all of them have swearing in them. Every tweet that we have rolling in right now.
Is there one you can clean up? No, I'm beyond intrigued.
Honestly, who gives a bleep? Selfish owners, selfish players, the rest of the world is struggling, millionaires fighting billionaires. I don't need baseball. Netflix is fine by me. They can all screw themselves. That's a good summation of what we're getting right now.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them.
Tim, let me, we got a break here in a couple of minutes, but let me throw this out. And I don't know if it's a today discussion, tomorrow. It sounds like we'll have a lot of time to talk about Major League Baseball's plight because there won't be baseball. In 94, fans came back eventually, mainly because of guys on steroids. They came back.
And then they made a 30 for 30.
And they made a 30 for 30, which was insulting in every way, but that's another topic for another night. What happens here?
There was one line from Costas.
Yeah, one.
One line.
And one line from McGuire. Later on, I learned it wasn't a really cool thing to do. Remember that one? That's what McGuire said. Later on, it wasn't a really cool thing to do. I would find out. Yeah. Give me a break. Do fans come back after this? And again, listen, the commissioner can come out tonight and say 48-game season, 50-game season, whatever. But this relationship has been poisoned. Absolutely.
This might be the stupidest move in the history of sports.
I'm trying to find one that would rival it, aside from blowing a 28-3 lead in a Super Bowl.
Name me the. Let's do it. Let's do what is the stupidest move in the history of sports, and then we'll compare it against players and owners fighting over a couple $100 million in a $1 billion industry during a global pandemic and 40 million or so in North America being unemployed.
Let's throw that out on social media. It's a great idea. Let's throw that out.
We'll compare
Tim and Sid. We'll compare it. I'm sure there's some good answers out there.
Listen to more of Tim and Sid weekdays from 5 to 7. Coming up, more Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Smith and Jones.
Pleased to be joined by our friend from ESPN and the undefeated Mark Spears. Spearsy, how you doing today?
Oh, man, just trying to figure out the world, brother.
Yeah, I hear you on that, and I saw your post even just from I guess it was earlier this morning, earlier today, late last night, even just the one lone model car that you said in your post on Instagram, the number 43 car for Bubba Wallace. Spearsy, that, let alone so many other stories over the last 3-4 weeks, it is it's a strange time in the world, let alone in the sporting world, period. And that's putting aside all of the COVID and Corona stuff as well. It's certainly an important time, but a very difficult time, to say the least. And that's coming from a white man, let alone, some of the other issues that we're discussing.
But, you know, and I also think it's a great time because conversations are happening. Like, all this that we were talking about, that took place before George Floyd, now.
Sure.
It has been going on for a long time. And, you know, for my generation, it was Rodney King. For my parents and Jonesy's parents, it was the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, this is nothing new for me. This is my life since birth. And so I'm when it happens, I'm not surprised. You know, like, it's that's just per the norm for me. So I think the positive now is, like, that there do seem to be people who, you know, that turned a blind eye that are now paying attention. And so I remember talking to my sister about it, and I'm like, I just don't get it. Why all of a sudden, you know, and I love all my white brothers and sisters who are, like, suddenly, like, fighting for the cause. But it do, I'm just like, so why all of a sudden now? Like, why this and not Ahmaud Arbery a month ago or Trayvon Martin years ago or, you know, well, why all of a sudden now? Because this isn't new. This has been happening for a long time. And my sister said, well, we can sit around and worry about that, but that we can't change the past, but at least people care now. So that's the only, like, silver lining in all this nightmare, is that I think there will be change. And I think the main reason why there will be change is because of the youth. You know, the youth don't seem to care if you're gay, what color you are. They care about, you know, the society that they're going to live in the future, and everybody getting treated the same. And so they are my hope. And I hope that, you know, one day when I have a child, the world that I've lived in will be a lot different for the world they live in.
I hear you, Mark. I have three biracial kids, and they grew up with the stories. They grew up with the stories, and, you know, they don't, how do I say this? They don't present always as people of African descent, and they're about the human race, and that's the way we've taught them. That's the way we brought them up. So, you know, as the great Wayne Embry said to us last week on our first show, he's hopeful now because of the diversity in the protesters. The look is different, and people are finally saying, no, we're not going to stand for this. And you're right. Rodney King was hit with a baton 57 times, and the four guys that did it got off. You know, the jury ruled that, you know, they weren't guilty. So, I mean, what George Floyd, like, what more heinous evidence do you need to drive change? So I'm like you, Mark. I'm encouraged. I really, really am. I hope that people maintain the energy. It started off with a bang, and there were conversations, and everybody speaking up. We're a month out now. Let's hope it keeps going with the same fervor and you know, vociferous nature that it started out with. But anyway, Mark, let's get to some hoops, man.
To your point, and I'll say this real quick. I think what happened with Bubba Wallace is just a reminder to everybody that even with all this momentum, that's why that fire continue is important. Mm-hmm. Like, racism's been around for hundreds of years. So it's a cause.
You can't kill a cause. So, you've got it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the same fire that I think a lot of people feel right now, I want them to feel that the rest of their lives, not just now.
I hear you, Mark. Let's talk some hoops. That's where Eric and I want to go with you. I'm not sure when we're going to see you again. Thankfully, the last big trip before the NBA shut down, I got 3 nights with you hanging out in San Francisco. So I'm thankful for that. But your thoughts in general, Eric said it off the top of the show. People are fleeing Florida, and the NBA is going right into the fire. How important is it that all the guys are diligent around the health side of these concerns to make sure that this virus doesn't get into the bubble and start disrupting everything that the NBA has planned?
Well, they call Disney is the happiest place on earth. And I think this bubble could be the healthiest place on earth. Like, somebody was telling me about, well, the teams are coming in and they're going, you know, the airport, there are all these people. I'm like, they're not flying into Orlando Airport. You know how these guys travel? They're going to some private airport. When they get off the plane, there's going to be a bus sitting on the tarmac waiting for them. Hey, they don't travel like us commoners, you know. And they're going to get taken directly to their hotel on the Disney property. And I was told there's like two different checkpoints that they have. So no one's going to be able to sneak in there. And in terms of the Disney employees, I don't even know if the players will really even see them. They'll go clean their rooms when they're gone. If anything, if they see somebody, they might be scared because, you know, there's going to be cameras everywhere. So they don't want to have much any interaction with any of the people that are coming into that bubble at all, whether it's the NBA players, the coaches, personnel, or even the media. I think they just want to do their job and get out of the way. So I don't know that, to me, like, there is a group of people that can know how to clean the right way and do their job and move away. It's the Disney folks. So I think for the group inside the bubble, it's going to be super safe. And to me, like, the way you're seeing these college football teams in America, like, players getting sick, the same way you're seeing baseball players going to camp and getting sick, it's because they have public access. These guys aren't going to have public access. That, to me, like, I think, you know, keeps putting a nail on the point of why they need to be in the bubble and why Dr. Fauci in America says that they think the NBA is doing the best thing.
Speaking with Mark Spears from ESPN and The Undefeated, Spearsy, everything you just said, I wholeheartedly agree with. I guess the only thing, if we go back, say, 3-4 weeks ago, when we first started, you know, hearing about the bubble and talking about the bubble, my thought off the bat was it's beyond safe considering it's contained in one area behind the gates, and, of course, nobody's going to be allowed to leave. Now, I know you just touched on this, but that's my only surprise in all of this, that whether there is interaction with the employees or not, and there's no denying this comes at a massive cost if you were to do this, I'm just a little bit surprised that the NBA, or Disney for that matter, is allowing cleaning staff, hotel staff, front desk, you know, the banquet group, the private chefs and everything to come in and out every single day. Because maybe I'm too paranoid, Mark. Jonesy and I have talked about this. We might be the worst ones for each other. But I haven't ordered takeout yet in 4 months because I'm the guy that says, but I don't even trust who's cooking my food, who's prepping my food if I go to a restaurant, if I order takeout. So I'm only trusting myself and my wife to prepare my meals. Are these guys going to be worried about who cleaned their room in the 3 hours that they were gone? They go back in, and was the person that cleaned their room sick? Is the person that's prepping their food sick, et cetera? I wonder if the league needs to say, hey, we're taking care of the Disney employees too, and you got to sign off on a deal that you can't leave the bubble while the NBA is here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's, you know, to the point of why you won't see them, you know.
Yeah.
They'll probably know each team's schedule. And trust me, you want them to clean their room. You don't want to leave it to these folks to clean. I want them to clean my room when I'm in there. You know, I do a much better job than I will. I just think that the teams will probably have to tell them what their schedule is, when they're going to be at the arena, when they're going to be at practice. And then all of a sudden, these folks are going to show up and clean up and do their thing and keep it moving. And I'm sure they'll have masks. I'm sure they'll have gloves. Trust me. I think the one thing that the last thing Disney wants is anybody to say that one of their employees who are on the outside are getting anybody sick. So, shoot, they might have them dressed up as Mickey Mouse, for all I know, and going in and, you know, with the costume on, cleaning up. So I am confident that it will be a very – whoever comes in and out, like, it ain't like, some dude coughing with no gloves on cleaning up. You know what I mean? Sure that they're going to make sure whoever does this, they're going to get temperature checked. You know, I'm sure they outside, they'll probably get tested on a regular basis. Like any precaution that they can take from a union standpoint, I'm sure they will. So, and then in terms of the food, like the players, they might have a chef that's inside that lives there. I'm not totally certain about that, but the players, they are also allowed to have their own personal chef drop off food for them. You know, and that can be delivered to them as well. So it's complicated, but trust me, like you guys are, you travel with the team. You see, I've been on the team planes before. Nobody gets treated better than these cats. And I'm sure it'll be the same way in Disney.
Mark, in spite of all that, and Adam Silver and the Players Association doing everything to try and ensure safety, I just saw something where Davis Bertans has said, and he's a free agent, so he's got something to play for. He says, I'm not coming back. I'm not going to play. I know the deadline, I believe the deadline's Wednesday for players to opt out if they are.
Yeah.
In spite of all that we've just talked about and how rigorous and diligent they're going to be around safety concerns, there will be guys that say, you know what, I'm not playing. How are those guys going to be viewed by their peers, not just in the moment, but going forward in terms of the union and the solidarity? And at the same time, if a guy's not comfortable, you can't tell him how he's supposed to feel. He's not comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, but it sounds like he wasn't comfortable for free agency reason, not because of COVID or social justice, you know. That kind of, I don't know that I necessarily like, I'm trying to protect myself for free agency deal. You know what I mean? Call Lords of London and get a, you know, tell the teams to protect them that way. But to me, if I'm a team, like the Raptors are going to be in, right? But if I'm Washington.
Yeah, chance for a championship. I hope so.
Yeah. No, what I mean is they're in the playoffs. They're good. They ain't fighting for a playoff spot. They're fighting for playoff positioning. But for a team like the Washington Wizards, like, you got to be disappointed. You want all hands on deck. Like, John Wall can't play, and then this guy who's a major part of their team is not going to play because of free agency. Like, it kind of sounds to me like somebody who's like, I ain't going to play in the bowl game because, you know, the draft is coming. You know, if Bertrand's reasons are for free agency reasons, if I was a teammate, I probably wouldn't be too happy about it.
Speaking with Mark Spears from ESPN and the Undefeated, Spearsy, when we look at this again from on the floor, you mentioned Toronto obviously having something to play for, so many other teams, with championship visions. Is there one team that you can say that has more of an advantage or disadvantage than another when we talk about all teams coming back essentially after a 4-month layoff and trying to pick up where they left off?
You know, I think one team, perhaps the better way to say it is, I think one team that really is going to be aided by this is the Clippers. Because the Clippers didn't really have a great training camp because their two main guys are hurt. Now they're healthy. So they get a training camp together towards the end of the season. And they're healthy, so their team will be healthier. And they added Morris. So, like, they get a chance to be on the same page. And to me, in the Western Conference, that is a scary, scary team. I actually picked the Clippers to win it all. And I think at full strength, they're better than the Lakers. I know what happened the last time. Kawhi didn't have a good game. The Lakers looked a little bit better, but just pound for pound, I think the Clippers are the best team in the NBA. And I also think for a team like Toronto, it's certainly helpful because now you're not as fatigued from last season anymore, the length of last season. All your guys are rested. All the little extra nicks and pains that they have, they should be. So to me, I mean, I think Kemba Walker will be healthier, obviously, and, you know, perhaps it helped Joel Embiid a lot too. But for the champs, I think this certainly will benefit them a lot in them being able to put their best team forward in a healthy and rested fashion. So to me, the two teams that are going to benefit most from this layoff are the Raptors and the Clippers.
Mark, how much do you think hitting the ground running with the way that everything's been truncated is important in the practice games, in what's left of the regular season? It's normally a time when you want to be playing your best ball of the year, and you've been playing all year, and now we've had a 3-month break in there. How important is it to hit the ground running right now?
Well, I mean, you get eight games to kind of work out the kinks, maintain your playoff position, try to get higher. I don't think you can catch the Bucks, but at least you got to try to maintain the number two spot. And if there's one thing I never really doubted with your guys, is that they're going to be ready. Like, they still got a chip on their shoulder. You lose Kawhi, they're not going to do anything. Okay. Serge Ibaka told you at the beginning of the season, don't sleep on us. And so there is one thing about the Raptors. I know mentally they'll be ready. Now physically they'll be ready. You have eight games to work out the kinks, continue your position. There certainly is some familiarity there. I really like their opportunity, and I would not be surprised if they're back in the finals again. They are certainly capable of beating anybody in the East. And I felt that way since the beginning.
Listen to more of Smith and Jones, weekdays from 1 to 2. Coming up, more Best Of, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the Best Of, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Good Show with Ben Ennis and J.D. Bunkus.
Kevin Pangos, Team Canada, and Barcelona FC guard joins us on the line right now. Kevin, thanks for doing this. How's it going in Spain right now?
It's going well. Thanks for having me out here. We're kind of just in the middle of our tournament that we kept going here, and got about a week or a week and a half left, so we'll see.
Yeah, what's it been like from a personal level, the safety that you feel, you and your young family living with you?
Honestly, pretty well. At the moment, though, I'm here by myself and just my teammates. My family's back in Barcelona, so they weren't allowed to come on the trip. But I feel like going into this, everyone was kind of unsure how this would unfold. And I think they've done a pretty good job of constantly testing us and keeping the regulations, you know, pretty strict where, you know, we can't get into contact with much, which kind of sucks at the same time. But overall, for the virus and the safety, I think it's really smart.
How much are guys talking about that? Because, yeah, that has been something with a lot of players keep trying to say this is, hey, not having fun and making this feel more and more like a job does add stresses to the job that maybe you wouldn't consider from the outside.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like you can't really understand until you really go through it. I feel like I said, before we started this, I was really unsure with how it was going to go. You know, me and my family were talking, you know, this can be brutal. You know, we could be away from the family for a really long time. Didn't know, especially because, as you mentioned, we have two leagues over here. So there's the Spanish league that we play in, and then we also play in a Euro league. So they're completely separate from each other. And they were initially thinking that we were going to do both tournaments. at different times, which I don't know how that would have worked out, but they were trying to. And so that would have been a big chunk away from our families and everything. And when you get the human side of you, you know, we're all humans playing this game. That's really tough. And so at the end of the day, this tournament, we're here for, I think, a total of 3 weeks. Started off with just 6 days. We got here before the tournament started. We kind of quarantined and did some practices and training and stuff. And then a 2-week tournament with kind of two divisions, round robin, and then semifinals, finals. And so, yeah, it's not easy. You know, we can only stay in the hotel. You know, we can't leave to go out. We go from hotel to bus to gym, back to the bus and back to the hotel. So it's kind of just that, that routine all the time. But for 3 weeks, it's doable. You know, anything when you get 2 months, 3 months, that would be really, really tough. But I think they've done a good job of making it pretty fair.
So, yeah, I wonder how strict the regulations are keeping everybody in the bubble and making sure they don't do anything that's unnecessarily risky, because we've looked at the 113-page report and the list of things the NBA players are going to have to go through when they get down to Orlando, and some of those are like, wow, that's really above and beyond. You're going to be testing every day, and you're not allowed to play doubles ping pong. We're like, okay, like let's take it easy. Some of this stuff is either not going to be maintained or is maybe not necessarily necessary, but it's eyewash. Like how much are guys really playing by the rules there? Is there anything that's like really like, man, you're getting tested and you're doing this? Like, is everybody pretty much doing what they're told over there?
You know, that's actually a really good question. Yes and no. When I say that is, and I think everyone's doing a good job of following it for the most part, but to follow it 100% is like you said, almost ridiculous. Like not playing doubles ping pong, doing this and that. So I think initially the one that really shocked me was the first couple of days they had people serving our food. So the salad, the this, the that, we couldn't touch anything. We had to wear masks everywhere. But then we'd go over to like where the dressings, like the oil, vinegar, all this kind of stuff is, and we're all sharing those bottles, you know, so we're all touching. So it didn't kind of add up, you know, why we couldn't do one thing, but then they were over there and we could do the other thing, but they were the exact same. So some of the guys are just scratching their heads, and then like some of the guidelines just didn't add up the way that we thought they should have. So, but then that changed again. So they kind of progressed where they were really strict off the start. I think for the first 3 or 4 days until we got tested, I think twice. And after we were tested twice and nobody had the virus, then they started, you know, loosening it more. And then now it's the point where we kind of can do, when I say everything, we can play ping pong and we don't have to worry about keeping distances. You know, we can go up and talk to people on the other teams and not have to worry about, you know, doing any certain distance or this and that. So it's become a bit more normal, I guess you can say. But to start, it was quite strict.
Yeah, you know what, though? There's a real parallel for just basically everyone right now in that regard, that it's very strict, that it was, hey, stay inside, lock it down, don't see anybody, to, hey, now, like here in Ontario, it's, hey, you can have social circles of 10 people that you're interacting with, right? But as you start to feel a little bit safer and you start to kind of push boundaries a little, and you start to see like, okay, well, what's actually working, what actually allows people to sustain? Because, yeah, dude, there's a level of, I don't know how someone can just go from playing to a bus to a hotel room and not being with teammates for, yeah, a month or two. Like, it's not even reasonable. I don't know how you'd be able to ask guys to do that. That if you are together and that you are within that same bubble, that you should be able to participate in other activities. You should be able to, yeah, share the same condiments. That doesn't seem overly ridiculous that you guys want to.
Yeah.
What do you use over there? I guess it's like they don't have like mustard, right? Like what's the go-to condiment that the boys are fighting over at the tables?
That's why I said the oil and vinegar on all the salads. Yeah. That's what the oil and vinegar. We don't have the ranch or the Caesar or any of that kind of stuff, you know. Yeah. So it's all the oil and vinegar, which is, again, it just didn't add up because you can't touch the stuff to serve the food on your plate, but you can all, you know, hold the bottles of the oil and vinegar, no problem. So it didn't add up. And like I said, now it's this point where like they're not really worried about it. You know, we go to the room to play cards or we're around guys from the other team and socializing as much because we are in the same bubble and we've all been tested. I think now we've been tested a total of, honestly, I lost track, but let's say 7 or 8 times. I think every 2 days they try to do it. And so It's not enjoyable, the test, for anyone who's ever got it, but I think they've done a good job of keeping that in track.
Are you getting the deep nasal swab one? Because you guys must have been jealous when you saw the NBA. They just have the ones where it goes lightly around the rim. The punishment is if you break quarantine, then they deep swab you. That's like the right way that they're brain. Making guys stay by the rules.
See, we get the full on swab up your nose, touching your brain every single time. So I don't know. I didn't know there was a different one. And we also get the blood test. We got a couple of times too, not every time. So that's the way they're doing it over here.
So you said you're playing cards and stuff. How are you guys keeping busy? And like, what does it look like even in terms of your ability to go to a shoot around? Or is it pretty normal, the level of like time on the court you're getting now? And same with it, with the downtime, just having cards and being around your teammates at this point?
Yeah. So, for the practice, for the basketball stuff, it's pretty normal. The facility that we're working at is actually pretty good. They have about 7 practice courts and then a game gym. So there's plenty of time for teams to go do it. And again, there's not as many teams here as there would be in the NBA and stuff. There's a total of 12 teams. And so 6 play on one day, 6 play on the other for now. And so they're doing a good job spreading that out. So that part's pretty normal, actually. And you get off the bus, they have a routine, you get scanned, you get you know, you take your hand sanitizer, you go to the courts and your all that kind of stuff. So you're not in contact with much. And then free time here, we're just playing cards. Coach has us doing video and scout report like normal. Kind of getting your naps in, kind of the normal, getting your treatment. So the time passes pretty quickly, but it's not ideal. There is a small little area out there where you can get a little sun for a portion of the day. So that's been nice, so you're not just stuck within four walls. But there isn't really a sense of complete freedom. Oh, and the last thing just to add too is they opened some restaurants here, about 2 or 3, I think, that the teams can go to outside the hotel, where the teams can book it, and you take the bus, you go to the restaurant, and you have a secluded area, and then just like the gym, you get back on the bus, go to the hotel. So you're not in contact with anyone, but you can kind of get outside and feel like you're a little free. So that was actually a pretty good idea, I felt like, just to make you feel a bit more normal.
Are those restaurants like open to the public, but they shut them down if one of you guys, if a team decides they want to show up there and then everybody gets booted? Like, or how does that work?
I actually don't know. I couldn't tell you. I think they're closed off to everyone else, or at least that section. No, they would be. I think they're closed off to everyone, because the only time when we were there, there was us and one other team, and I didn't see anyone else, and we had like a patio or like a room to ourselves. And so those are the details. Like, I really don't know. There's like a whole book full of all the guidelines that they're following and stuff, and I just know the basics that I kind of see, but I'm sure there's all of these rules and stuff that they put into place that I haven't been aware of.
Talking to Kevin Pangos, Team Canada and Barcelona guard. So I was reading an interview with you, Kevin, when the discussion was taking place about the return to play and how much time you would need to get back into playing shape, because you weren't exactly living in a palatial estate with like 7 different courts, right? Like, so how did that work? How did you feel? Did you feel ready to play when it was finally go time?
Yeah, I'd say close. I don't think it's ideal circumstances. I think, even now, because the time that we had to prep and also the, amount of games we have in a short window, I think it's not ideal. I think our team did a pretty good job, and the players on our team, you know, props to them. I think everyone kind of took it seriously, knowing to try and take care of their body the best they could and, manage the time because they knew we didn't have a lot. But leading up to it, everyone was kind of really worried and just didn't feel right, you know, because it's not just like you took time off. Like, you took time off and couldn't do much at all. Like, you're limited with the amount that you could do. And so our practices were sloppy, to say the least, and we really didn't have the best practice. But by the time we got here, I think that kind of turned around, and the games have actually been pretty solid. There's only been, I think, a couple injuries or bumps and bruises so far, which that's been great news. And so let's hope it continues that way.
Yeah, I was actually really curious about your game specifically, because you don't you don't become a great shooter by just like shooting casually. You shoot a ton. I'm guessing that your entire life you probably have markers of how many shots you want to get up a day, and all of a sudden you're in the middle of a pandemic, and when they start to talk about returns, first of all, this has to be the that has to be the longest stretch of, I don't know, since you were young, of not getting those reps in. But were there little things that you tried to do, whether they were just like ball handling drills or stuff that you kind of created on your own to try and have some semblance of keeping a basketball routine?
Yeah, no, honestly, it was the first time, I don't think I've ever gone that long without shooting the basketball. You know, when you get to this point, when you play every single day, when you go 2 or 3 days without shooting or touching a basketball, you come back and it feels strange. So I don't even know what it was, 6 weeks, 8 weeks without it was crazy. And so I tried to do the best I could. We have a balcony at our place and the weather was nice, so we'd be out there and I'd shoot up in the air and stuff, but that only does so much to keep a little bit of feeling. I'd do my exercises and stuff to keep my legs and stuff as strong as they could, because that's obviously important with shooting as well. And so I tried to do the best I could, and when I came back, it definitely wasn't ideal. I wasn't feeling perfect, but tried to get as many reps on the court as I could after that to get in the groove as fast as possible. And so overall it was fine, not ideal, but I think you talk to anyone in the situation and nothing's been ideal about it, so we kind of just got to go with what we got, and it's been good.
Hey, before we let you go, is it easy for you to imagine a world where there's international competitions or international basketball right now? Like, I know that you're focused on this and you just went through a pandemic with your family, but have you put any thought at all into like the future of Canada basketball or the future of international events? Because they kind of seem bleak from over here right now.
Yeah, actually, I haven't thought much about it since I heard that the Olympics was postponed and the qualifiers as well. And so, at this point, it's everyone's best guess what's going to happen in the future. Like I just heard you guys at the beginning, the cases are spreading here and some places are controlling it okay, and then all of a sudden it'll pop up again somewhere else. So it's so unpredictable. And so at this point, I hope for the best, because, this is my profession. This sports is what I love, not just basketball. Like, watching other sports, watching other competitions, I feel like a lot of people are in that situation where they just love to watch sports and support it. And so you'd love to see, this stuff fixed because of that, but also just for general life, all the people passing away from this is just tragic. So you want to see some improvement with this overall, and you just hope for the best. And on the side of sports, definitely, I hope going forward that they can figure this thing out and we can get going like normal, but we'll see.
Listen to more of Good Show with Ben Ennis and J.D. Bunkus weekday mornings from 9 to noon. This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Tim and Sid.
We are now joined by the Baseball Hall of Famer, the greatest Toronto Blue Jay ever. He'll never say that, but I'll say it with him on the line. It's Roberto Alomar joining us today here on Tim and Sid. Robbie, it's been too long, man. There's a lot happening. You're in San Juan, Puerto Rico. How are things there? How are you holding up?
Well, things are good. They're not too bad. We're still struggling with the virus. You have to be really careful. The protocols are all over the place. Here in Puerto Rico, you have to be home by 6 o'clock. And they're really strict. You have to make sure you stay the distance from the people and be smart about it.
Yeah, same could be said about anywhere in the world right now. Be smart about it. It's great advice. Hey, and as if there weren't enough going on, is there like Sahara sands blowing across Puerto Rico now? Like, what is that?
Yeah, that's all over the place, man. I don't know. Like, it's really really hot. But I'm used to the weather. But it's a little bit different. Hopefully, it goes away really really soon. We'll see what happens.
Rob, before we kind of get into it, I've been told your sweater has significant meaning. What's going on with the sweater?
This is French. French is a company from Canada. They're in Calgary. They want me to say a shout out, hello to French. Thank you for the sweater. And they're great people. I had a good friendship with them, and they send me clothes. So just want to give them a shout out.
Nice. Listen, you wrote a letter in both Spanish and English about what's happening as baseball tries to get back. Why did you feel the need to put something out on the internet?
Well, so you guys know that I work for the commissioner with the commission MLB, and I also was a player once, and I also work for the Jays organization. To me, I needed to say something. It's because I love the game of baseball, and I know that we all, the only thing we talk about is always it's about the players and about the owners, but we never talk about the fans. We never talk about the people that work at the ballpark. And I know a lot of people are hurting at this time, especially in this time, hurting that they don't have a job, they have a family to take care of. So that was kind of my message, to see both organizations can get together, and hopefully they get into a common sense. And I know we are going through this virus, and if we can get to a common sense where we can at least play some baseball game, it will be great for the people who have no job and for the fans to watch a game, at least on TV.
Roberto Alomar, Baseball Hall of Famer here on Tim and Sid. The first line in your statement, Robbie, you said, quote, "I'm in pain over what's happened to the game that I love," end quote. How shocked are you that as today began, this back and forth with ownership and players still wasn't over?
Well, sometimes it's shocking, but you really don't know what sometimes you cannot get involved in the conversation because I am not part of the owner,
ownership group.
Association group, and also the player association. For me, I just want to say something and say I am in pain because I'm not watching the game that I love. And I want to see, you know, sometimes we think about the players that are playing at this moment in the big league, but there's some kids who are playing in minor league who have dreams to become big leaguers. And especially this year, there's not going to be no minor league baseball. So what those kids are going to do? So they really are losing 1 year of their playing time. And that's what I refer. I refer more to the, let's get something done. Let's take the precautions and try to play baseball. So at least the young guys, too, can get ready for hopefully next year.
Robbie, I see this often when we're talking about sports, that people live in the present, the right now, oftentimes a little too much, and that sometimes we don't learn from the past. Even if it's there for us to read about and to understand, all three of us remember 1994. What do you remember most about 1994 and what it did to you and the game?
Well, for the player side, sometimes you have to realize that we are fighting for the guy who were retired. We wanted a higher pension. We wanted the salaries to go a little higher. So we were fighting for more the young generation and the guys like my dad who was retired, so they can have a good pension. So and that's what the player association sometimes fight about. I understand that. So, but it's the deep now, more money, and the owners, I believe, making a little bit more money. But sometimes we have to think about what do we need to do to help others. And that was really my message. My message was more, let's get something done. I went through a lot of pain in 1994. We lost almost a year. And it was nice to see baseball come back. And I don't want to see the fans go back to 94 and don't come back to the game. The last time in 94, we lost a lot of fans. So I don't want to see that happen. I think this is a great game. And it is an opportunity, especially for the young guy, go to the big league and make a living.
Roberto Alomar here on Tim and Sid. Is the feeling you get today, Robbie, about how the fans are absorbing this similar to 94? Now, I know 94 canceled the season. I understand it's not an apples-to-apples discussion right now. But do you feel fans are as angry today watching this as they were in 94?
I really don't know. I cannot answer you that question because there's so many things that are happening these days. Coronavirus, the things that happen in the United States, all over the place with the that happened to the cop, and that's really sad news.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many things that happen to this world, and people want something that is positive. People want positive stuff. We want to get along. We want baseball back. And I think baseball could be a way to people can get back together. Now that I'm talking about the topic, you know, in my house, we all look at people like equal. We all equal. We don't see colors. We see people, and that's why we always love. You know, in my house, they taught me to love each other no matter who they are. And I hope I can send that message. Let's get together, get along, and because this is a beautiful world. You know, we need to keep the world beautiful and able to travel any way, any place we want, go to a game any place we want, you know, go to churches and don't look at people looking at the color instead of looking at people.
Roberto Alomar joining us here on Tim and Sid. And I know you practice what you preach because you love to give back. I know canceling the T12 tournament in Toronto must have been tough, but I hear you're also doing some work with kids in Puerto Rico. Speak on, can you tell us a little bit about how hard it was to cancel the T12 in Toronto, but to know that you can work with kids in Puerto Rico?
Well, it is a little pain because once again, here we had chances to bring these kids to T12. So they can choose to need to sign as a professional or go to college. So this year we have to postpone. We have to get ready for next year, and just tell the kids, just tell the young guys, keep going, keep working hard, and you're gonna have your opportunity next year. So what I'm doing here in Puerto Rico, I'm trying to buy a franchise from winter ball, from a just a team. I want to have a team of, nice. In winter ball, and all the guys that I'm gonna try to help is the young guys that are 18, 19, that they don't give them the opportunity to play here professionally in the winter ball league. I'm gonna try to sign those kids to give them an opportunity to have a team and play against the other teams.
Nice,
that's awesome. Robbie, considering, I mean, you mentioned already the current state of minor league baseball, the state of minor league baseball going forward was going to be cut anyway. Those decisions had already been made. You going forward and trying to get a winter ball team in terms of giving people access to another opportunity going forward, how vital will situations like that be considering minor league baseball is going to shrink for a number of reasons over the next little while?
Well, it's going to shrink. And you know what, Tim? Now it's going to be more difficult for the guys to make it. But understand something. In life, we have to work hard for what we want. It's not going to come to you. So now the young guys, what they have to do is take life day by day, work hard, believe in their talent, and it's going to be more competition. And because it is more competition and less team, now you have to dedicate yourself. Right. If you want to play in this game and you want to, you know, play professionally, it's going to be competition there. So, you know, and that's why I always say this game is an individual kind of sport. Yes, you play as a team, but as an individual, if you do your job as an individual, you're doing your job for yourself and the team.
Right.
So now the kids have to take, you know, the young guys have to take day by day. What I have to do to become a better person and a better player today. Don't think about tomorrow. Think about today. And then when this day is finished, then think about tomorrow. And it's going to be more competition, I think, and more challenging.
Robbie Alomar joining us here on Tim and Sid. Robbie, we've been doing a show, I guess, almost 4 months now without sports going on. And we've had a lot of conversations along the way. One of my favorites was with Buck Martinez, who told us about playing winter ball in Puerto Rico with Roberto Clemente. And Sid and I just smiled the entire conversation because it was amazing. What does winter ball in your home and native land mean to you?
To me, I always tell everybody, when I used to play in the States, And I remember, I can tell you a story, when I was 17 years old, and this is why the league in Puerto Rico is so important. When I was 17 years old, I was picked on the draft. You have to go to a draft. They pick you in the draft, and I was only 17. My manager, Felipe Alou, who I admire, and I thank him a lot for giving me the first opportunity to play in winter ball. They're supposed to bring a player from USA, and the guy couldn't come. So he decided to come a little later. So they put me to play in second base. They gave me the chance. They gave me the opportunity. And from that day on, I was their second baseman.
Right.
That tells you how important it is, because life is about opportunity. They gave me base. I make the best of it. I work hard. And I stay with the position. And from that point on, I played two more years, and then I was in the big leagues. So it tells you, for me, it was the foundation. It was my base to understand the game and to become a better player.
A lot of Blue Jay fans are thankful that the decision was made.
Yes. Felipe Alou is a smart man.
It's really a smart man.
Did you like second base, Robbie, when you first played it? Did you like it?
You know, I never played second base in my entire career until I was they told me that when I turned 20, that I went to spring training with the San Diego Padres. That's when I started playing second base. I always play shortstop.
Wow.
The good kids always play shortstop. That's what they do. They throw them out at shortstop and let them go.
I wasn't good enough at short, so that's why they changed me to second. No, I'm just kidding.
So you wouldn't have been a Hall of Famer at short. Robbie Alomar wouldn't have been a Hall of Famer at short as well. You don't think?
Hey, I cannot predict, but I know I am a Hall of Famer at second. So I don't know.
That's true.
Before we let you go, last one from me. What do you miss most about baseball? Like I was talking about this with a friend of mine. Like the specific thing that I miss the most about baseball is like watching a shortstop glide deep into the hole and either flip that long throw to first base. Sorry, I'm a lefty, so I did it with my left hand. There's no shortstops that are left-handed, but you know what I'm talking about. Flip that or the Derek, you know, Tony Fernandez used to do that sidearm, just that flip over to first, or Derek Jeter, the jump throw from deep in the hole. Like, what do you miss most about watching baseball?
Well, you talk like a fan.
Yeah.
I was more like a player. I can talk like I was a player.
Yeah.
I love making a great play, getting the other guy mad. I love being with my teammates. I love traveling. And I love the game. And I really love the game. I was really blessed with a great talent. But I also was blessed with a great family. You know, the foundation, the base. Especially in my house with my mom and my dad and my whole family. That was why I was able to achieve so many goals in my life. It is because of them. Because without the support from the people that you don't know, it is really challenging to make it to the big leagues and also continue to stay in the big leagues. So to me, I was really, really blessed to have a great family.
Listen to more of Tim and Sid weekdays from 5 to 7. Coming up, more Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Writer's Block.
A must follow is at Clint Yates. His government name is Clinton Yates, columnist for The Undefeated, panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn. There are so many angles to go with this race conversation in sports. When people say stick to sports, it's really tough nowadays. Let's just start what happened in NASCAR last night, but what's really continued to happen. When you saw on your timeline what happened in this garage stall of Bubba Wallace, your first thought was what?
It was a little shocking from a order of operations standpoint, you know, because that day in Talladega, I mean, a lot of people don't really understand. If you're watching the race that day, first of all, the race got delayed. And anytime you have a race delay, you know, you're sort of hanging around the track just in terms of like the visual experience. And that's how we were availed of this knowledge of a guy flying a plane with the daggone Confederate flag around the super speedway that also said defund NASCAR on it. So not only was there that, there was also the situation of trucks lining up outside of the track. So, you know, this had already, for lack of a better term, been a pretty racist day in NASCAR. You know, none of that was obviously on the track or in the facility. So by the time the ESPY Awards get done, and there's, you know, a pretty nice showing from NASCAR, you come back to SportsCenter, and it's bang, by the by, there's a news here. It was kind of like, Jesus, okay. Well, this already crappy day that we tried to salvage has gotten worse. So I wasn't, you know, it wasn't some huge stunner. I mean, never mind the context of NASCAR. It wasn't a huge stunner just on the day, you know what I mean? Because there had already been that kind of environment around Talladega, which is what a lot of people around the sport were worried about. There were only a couple of hot spots where people thought there were going to be issues. This was one, and we saw them.
Clinton, there are some remarkable scenes out of NASCAR today. You could head to Clinton's timeline on Twitter, if you're on Twitter, and you'll see some of them, including Bubba Wallace being essentially leading all the drivers on the track and the drivers pushing him both literally and symbolically to the front of the field. Bubba Wallace took what I think will be a photo probably in every media outlet across the country that does sports and even beyond sports today with he took a selfie basically with all these drivers behind him. So Clinton, on the one hand, this kind of symbolism, I think, is really important. I think it's powerful. On the other hand, I live in the real world, and I understand what NASCAR's history is, and I understand that we're only a day removed from a banner flying above the track that someone paid for to say, defund NASCAR. You've written about this. You've been covering it. How do you process what has happened today with sort of the larger what has been going on with NASCAR for decades?
I think we're looking at a league that's doing a pretty good job of trying to take this day by day. And I don't mean that in the context of, like, thinking that they have to own every story and every second of everything at every moment. You know, that's one of the sort of things that I feel like it's going to sound a little weird of a tangent, but in today's PR world, the strategy of owning every moment is something that oftentimes comes across as a bit disingenuous. And I think in this situation, NASCAR's sort of flexibility and willing to react in real time without necessarily assuming they have all the answers is kind of refreshing because of the nature of what's happening. You know, on the call today, NASCAR's president basically said, look, you know, we don't know what we're going to do when we find this person because we don't know what we found. You know, the FBI is involved and so on and so forth. And I think that's a relatively healthy outlook on this. If it turns out that some team had some covert operation to do this, you know, that's a totally different story than one random person deciding that they want to stick a noose, you know, in somebody's locker. And overall, you know, NASCAR's got a much bigger issue on their hands about just how they're going to try to adjudicate this stuff more largely as far as their product is concerned. So, you know, as a fan of the league for, you know, two decades, and just as kind of a person in the sports world right now, I don't need NASCAR to own everything. I don't need them to act as if they have this under control because it's not, you know. And the way to tackle that to me is by admitting that and by listening to your people. And so the situation with Bubba that just unfolded in terms of him taking the selfie, that's cool. There's no way they planned that. You know what I mean? But, like, they're being adaptable. And that's really half the battle in this situation. You know, can NASCAR adapt? And can they find a reason – rather, can they convince a certain portion of their fans to find a reason to do so as well? That's looking like what is going to be the hard part. Never mind just telling people we're not racist. I mean, you know, we're assuming on some level the benefit of the doubt on that, just in terms of the people involved. But when these things keep cropping up, and if we can't find a way to believe that you're punishing people in a way that shows that you care outside of just trying to make yourself look better, that's when we'll have an issue. If they find this person and we don't know who it is and we never find out who it is, I think that looks bad, you know, and I'm not necessarily saying it's going to be the most productive thing and that people need a pound of flesh. But, like, for fans who are looking at this on the outside saying the reason why I don't come to sports, or rather I come to races, the reason I don't feel safe here as a fan is because, like, we never really know who's going to pop up out of nowhere and pull some racist nonsense. once you start identifying people who are actually doing it, it might actually feel safer for those who are coming in from the outside. So, you know, we'll see how they treat this going forward. But like I said, on the call today, they seem to have a pretty good idea of what it's going to take, which is a whole lot. It's not going to be fun.
Yeah, on being adaptable, I love that they adapted the policy of, yeah, you can hand in your Confederate flag for another flag, to starting to say it with their chest and banning the Confederate flag. And really, it's, we're talking about a symbol, right? And we can give symbols as much power as we want to. You have a column about the symbols of actual people that represent racism for large communities. On The Undefeated, you write about the removal of the statue of Calvin Griffith outside of Target Field and George Preston Marshall outside of RFK Stadium. And these are two stadiums and fan bases and cities that mean something to you. How does the removal of those actual symbols address racial injustice? Does it? Can it?
No. I mean, what it does is it just makes me less annoyed that I have to see this kind of crap, which is a huge discussion. I'm serious, in terms of just the general mental energy that black folks spend walking around anywhere having to be, you know, themselves and, you know, deal with their own dignity. I mean, that's what that's about regarding statues. I mean, the Confederate flag on a larger level is a much bigger deal than any singular statue, in my opinion, that may or may not stand outside of any sporting venue. That's a personal opinion. I mean, that's why this NASCAR thing is so important, because this is the last, you know, bastion of hope for people who were trying to consider the Confederate flag any sort of respectable thing. It was like, well, they have a NASCAR, and NASCAR is pretty popular. And if NASCAR at least took the stance that we don't want these anymore, then those people are being officially chased into a corner. Statues change with the political whims of those who put them up and those who take them down. So, you know, that is going to change. But, like, there's something specific about the Stars and Bars that's very different, you know? And I use that colloquial term just to point out how regular that image is and how people have side nicknames for something that represents something so hateful. So I'm not, you know, those are personal to me in that I love baseball and it's my favorite sport and it's what I care the most about. And I ended up going to a lot of different things at RFK, and so it was just weird to have that there. But more largely, absolutely not, man. The Confederate flag is the biggest single, like, anthropological change I've seen happen in sports in my life. You know, because I'm only 40 years old, so it's not like I saw Jackie Robinson integrate anything or whatever. But, you know, I think NASCAR is in a big position here as a result. They've got a serious responsibility that they're going to have to figure out how they're going to handle, and whether or not it's going to be more punitive or more pacifist, we don't know yet.
Clinton, you know, I realize the era that we live in. We live in a time where the most powerful person in the world is calling out media on a daily basis as either enemies or calling out all news as fake. So I understand that when the Bubba Wallace, when a noose is found, NASCAR announces a noose is found in Bubba Wallace's garage, there's going to be immediately hordes of people, particularly online, who say this is a hoax, this is not true. I guess, and I'm not naive to this, I guess the speed of that today surprised me. And maybe that's my own naivete. You know, maybe I figured it would take 6 hours instead of a half hour. When you observe that, what do you think that speaks to? What do you think that speaks to, that there are going to be immediately a, I'm not saying it's certainly majority because it's not, but a significant enough amount of people who believe that this did not happen. This is a hoax. This is a setup when it comes to people who are trying to push, in their minds, racial agendas.
I don't know the exact phrase that it is that I'm looking for here to answer your question, but I'm sure that it exists in some form of rhetorical discussion that I don't know. But the people who do push that, I don't feel most of those people do that in good faith. And I honestly don't actually think that number is as significant as we think. I think there's a certain level of, I'm not saying from you, but in general, there's a certain level of concern trolling in that. And that's the sort of phrase, the turn of phrase I'm trying to look for that I don't know, in that, like, the NASCAR's president today, he addressed that question. He just said, dude, I can't even reply to that. Like, it's personally offensive to me to think that that's something that we would be going through the motions of doing for the sake of what exactly? You know, like, you know, it's an intellectually small argument to imply that somebody would plant something like that, because it also is incredibly racist in just how it self-centers
the white gaze in terms of what people think about racist rather than what the actual act is. And that's why it's so like stupid to even think about, like, why would I do that, something like that to myself? So I could, you know, what, accuse you of being a racist? Do you think I would rather just deal with you not doing that so I could get on with my life? You know, like, this is what I tell people all the time. Like, black folks ain't doing nothing but minding their business. You know what I'm saying? Ain't nobody going around looking to tell people racist. You know, that's not how anybody spends their time. That's ridiculous, you know? So any notion of that, to me, if you're arguing it in good faith, is a clear indication that you probably need more black friends. And I say that, you know, in all sincerity, because that just is not something anybody has the time to do, yo. It's just not how anybody wants to live. That's the whole problem to begin with.
Yeah, Bubba Wallace is not Jussie Smollett. Like, those are two different people, and we should treat them differently. You mentioned, you know, you're 40 and baseball is your favorite sport. I'm close in age. I'm 37, and I say baseball was my favorite sport. And I actually watched the Griffey, the junior doc on MLB Network last night, and it brought me back to a time when baseball was my favorite sport, when he was my favorite athlete, and how far removed that feels. And I'm sitting with the fact that the MLBPA and the MLB right now are fighting over basically the amount of money that Steven Strasburg is going to get paid on this contract. And I'm not really sure why, when they could have this stage all to their own and be some young kid's favorite sport right now. Very simply, what is baseball doing right now? Like, I just feel like screaming to Rob Manfred, help me help you.
Well, there's a couple things there. Baseball's my favorite sport, but not for reasons that have anything to do with just the major leagues. I mean, I like baseball as a sport, as a game, as it relates to the youth game, as it relates to the global game, never mind Major League Baseball. So, know that. As for the bigs, I mean, you know, I don't – I think there's a lot of misconceptions about, like, what is the best case and the worst case scenario regarding this season. I don't think the worst case scenario is not playing baseball. I mean, sorry. Like, I was having lunch with a big leaguer last week. And he said 30 to 40 of the guys he knows that are around his age are, and he used this word, indifferent about whether or not this season comes back. So between the combination of interest from players, which I think is legit just on a hassle level in terms of health concerns, in terms of being able to be with your families, and in terms of, like, competition level, you got to understand here, man, that, like, players are not just replaceable entities at every single level just because they happen to wear the same jersey or the same uniforms. Like, that's just a ridiculous notion. And so, you know, I don't think people understand that. You got to make sure that these guys are relatively happy because they're the ones who have to play, and they play better when they're happy. And so baseball, what they're doing is exposing owners as people who don't really care that much about the game. You know, they don't really have that much of an interest outside of what it can make their money on. And that's what's really terrible. Like, it's not just about how much more money some millionaire makes. It's about the notion of your self-worth. And if you trusted an owner to this point for reasons I will never understand, well, then they've laid bare that you probably shouldn't, and that it's not about just the money. It's about what do you think the actual value is of the people who played the game. And if you're going to decimate the minor leagues, well, then obviously you don't care about the development of the game. And that's kind of where I'm like, yo, this isn't even, like, funny. Like, there's no stance against the players in this situation because, hello, the player numbers are literally getting eliminated by the people who claim that they want to play baseball. So that just doesn't add up. And when you think about it that way, beyond just the top flight, you understand how hard this is to everybody. I mean, there's kids who, let's say you got drafted 4 years ago, 3 years ago. You know, you might have been in a double-A situation. You might have even been in triple-A. But now, what are you looking at? Maybe you're behind two guys at a position. You're not getting on a major league roster. Maybe you make the taxi squad, and then you're just not playing for a year or whatever it is. And God knows if you're actually going to have a team literally in existence when you come back. This is much bigger than Major League Baseball, yo. The owners are destroying the game from the top down, and it's affecting every single level. And so when I see things like, you know, guys who are in single-A squads who are calling me up asking me how they can get a job in baseball that's not playing, dude, it breaks my heart. You know what I'm saying? That's what cares. That's what breaks my heart. Not just whether or not some guy in the big leagues is going to be able to get his bonus salary because he got an escalator clause because he played 25 games or whatever.
Listen for more of Writer's Block weekdays from 2 to 5. Coming up, more Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. This is the Best Of Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Earlier on Hockey Central.
Let's bring aboard George McPhee. He's the president of hockey operations for the Vegas Golden Knights, and he joins us now. Very glad to have you aboard today. And we were just talking about the merits of Vegas as a hub city. And it seemed as if, George, right away, right out of the gate, after this concept, you know, got royal assent, it seemed as if Vegas distinguished itself right away as an obvious choice. From your point of view, why was that? What did your town do so well?
Well, first of all, before I can talk about that, I have to say I don't know any more about this than you guys do, to be as honest as I can be with this. The league is going to make a decision, and some people have reported that we're one of the hub cities, but we're not aware of that. So I would say it was, with respect to Vegas, with all that they can do, I think anytime, you know, a tourist goes to Vegas and you get into one of the hotels, you rarely leave because they have everything there, your meals and all your entertainment. You can work out there, theaters, sports book, spas. You can get a haircut, whatever you need. It's all there. And people can get into one of these hotels and just literally never leave on a weekend. So they certainly have the capacity to do that. These hotels, some of them have as many as 6,000-7,000 rooms. And, you know, I think what I had heard was, and the analogy they used was, just imagine you're getting onto a cruise ship. And you guys may have heard this already. You get tested before you go. You get tested every time you come in. You're tested often. Everybody that works there at that hotel stays in that hotel. They don't go home at night. The bus drivers taking you to and from the rink stay there. Everybody at the rink stays there at the hotel. So you're in the bubble. And so I guess that's how they started this. And that was the pitch they made. And certainly with all the capacity they have, and it is, you know, obviously Vegas is a hospitality town. It's a service business down there. Yep. And they're used to big, big events. And, you know, they can handle this one.
Berkey?
What about, thanks for doing this, Hobie. What about practice ice? Sure,
well, there's enough ice to go around. We have two sheets at our practice facility, and we are 15 minutes from the strip. About a mile down the road from us is the Las Vegas Ice Center. There's two sheets there. The Orleans, which is 1 mile off the strip, has a 6,000-seat rink where our American League team, the Silver Knights, will play next season while our new arena is being constructed. And by the way, we had 9,500 season ticket deposits for our team.
Great.
Our American League team. The MGM Grand on the strip has a rink in it. If they want to use it, then there's another rink called the Sobey Rink in Henderson that's adequate. And who knows, maybe by August, we've got a practice facility that is up for our American League team. Not ready yet, but by August it might be.
Stewie?
You just mentioned the Henderson team. Is there any worries now that there might be a possible delay for next season, having it be their first season in the American Hockey League?
Sure. I you know, we don't know whether the American League will bring it on time. So we'll just have to see how that goes. But it is amazing what has happened in Vegas, as you know, with the big club. We built two facilities. T-Mobile Arena was there, and then we built a practice facility, and we were hoping that this expansion team would take hold and grow some roots and in the market and some deep roots, and it has. And now, you know, we've gone from one team and two facilities to two teams and four facilities, and the interest in the Silver Knights has been amazing. We literally have 9,500 season ticket deposits for a rink that's going to hold maybe 6,000, 6,500 seats. So I think it will do real well, and it's going to be nice to have it in 15 minutes away from us. But when we start is an unknown. Yeah, that's a big question mark.
When the NHL starts, and we all have our fingers crossed, let's assume this is towards the end of July into August at some point. Of the players that were injured at the pause, who's back for Vegas, George?
Everyone. Yeah, I don't know what players that you were aware of that were injured. We didn't, we weren't public with all of them, but they're all healthy. And we had a couple of those high ankle sprains that that take forever to heal, and sometimes you need the summer for them to heal. And we're fortunate that we've had this kind of time for them to heal. And a couple of other injuries, we're good. We had, I think, 24 players skate the first week, 28 the second week, and we'll probably have 30 this week.
See, that's frightening.
So they're all back. And most of the guys stayed because Vegas was a decent place to stay. Needless to say, the weather's good, and you don't have the density there that you have in other cities. You can get outside. You can take your kids for a walk. You can go to different places. And a lot of people went out into the canyons and went hiking and so on. And you see lots of things, and some scorpions and some tarantulas maybe, and maybe a wild Mustang or two, but you don't see any humans. So it was a good place for the guys to stay.
You know, the scary thing about saying that this is a team that's perfectly healthy is this is a team that after the coaching change and Peter DeBoer comes in, this is a scary team. Like, this is, you know, where once upon a time, you know, Vegas sort of surprised everybody and you guys went right through the league and right to the Stanley Cup final. And then all of a sudden, you know, teams started, you know, refused to take, you know, Vegas for granted, and it got tougher. Man, after the coaching change, this team turned into a juggernaut, and we've been waiting for it to happen all season long. Describe your team at the pause, George.
Well, we were playing well, and in fairness to Turk, we were a little bit healthier. We had, when we started the season, we had some players. Theodore had the cancer scare and didn't get a chance to train as much, and Nate Schmidt got hurt right before the opening game, and Tuck got hurt in the last preseason game. We had actually two or three other guys that got hurt late in the summer in training, and so we didn't start well. We got just as, you know, we're getting healthy, we ended up losing, Stone and Patch and a few of the other guys. But Peter came in and, did the best he could initially. And then we had the All-Star break. And, right after that, we played real well. We were well organized. We played a faster game. We allowed our defensemen to do more. And we improved our team at the deadline with the additions we made. So, one of the takeaways when, you know, we met with Bob Clark, we met with Doug Risebrow before expansion to sort of get a tutorial from them on how to do this. And one of the takeaways from Risebrow was, Bob Clark made it clear, you got to try and win right away. And Risebrow's takeaway was, keep the Stanley Cup in mind. Don't get too attached to players. And that would have been easy to do right after the first year, but you've got to keep the cup in mind and keep trying to improve your team. It's easy to say, a little harder to do. But we've kept that in mind, and we've worked at making the team better. All that said, who the heck knows what's going to happen when we get playing again? I think
True. You
can throw out all the analytics. You can throw out how a team was playing. Yeah. If you're a good team, well, so what? If you were not a good team, well, so what? I don't think anybody can predict what's going to happen now based on what happened during the season. It's a completely different time.
Berkey?
Yeah, I agree, but I like Kelly's moves at the deadline. I think that you were probably the team that added the most at the deadline, maybe Carolina, you could say, with the 2D. They thought they had to cover for Dougie Hamilton, and now they get him back. But you guys added some really important pieces, and I think that's going to be a real factor as we go forward if we get to play.
Yeah, you know, we certainly wanted to balance out our goaltending. We couldn't keep going to Flower. We needed someone else that with the experience and the ability to play. And so the Elaner addition was very good. The Martinez addition was very good. And he played really well when he came to us and gave us a little more offense than he had shown recently in L.A., which was also nice. And, you know, he can play all over your lineup and can play on the second power play and can play both sides, which, as you know, Berkey, is huge these days. Have a defenseman can play the left and right side. And then Zach Whitecloud came along and earned a promotion and played very, very well for us. The analytics on him were terrific. And Nick Cousins did a very good job of giving us that additional forward in the top nine, and again can play all over the lineup. So we were aggressive and gave up lots of picks and so on, and some players to do it, but it's all an effort to keep Risebrough's takeaway in mind. You gotta, you know, try to win the Stanley Cup.
Stewie,
you guys recently re-signed Ryan Reeves to a two-year contract extension. How big of an impact has he had, not just on the team on the ice, but the organization and in the community the last couple of years?
Well, he's been huge in this community. I'll tell you, he's got a knack for it. He's very, very personable, very good on television. And he did a tremendous campaign for the water department in Vegas. And when they did the metrics on it, it's all about conserving water. His campaign was so successful that the residents in Vegas used 22% less water than the year before during his campaign. So that was pretty darn good.
Did he threaten them?
That's what he did. The commercials show him throwing a guy through a window because he was using water when he wasn't supposed to. But he's been terrific on the ice for us, and that's obviously what's most important. Ryan Reeves is a really smart player. He's smart in, you know, the way he plays the game. He's got very good hockey sense. He gets us 8 or 9 goals a year. He doesn't take penalties, and he's taught Carrier to do that as well, to play hard, finish checks. But if a guy's vulnerable, you ease up, and they get the benefit of the doubt from the referees. They're smart about it. But they are, you know, really difficult to play against. They play hard. They play physical. They forecheck hard. They set the tone for the team. And Ryan Reeves is I always put the tough guys in different categories, and there were guys that that could just fight. They couldn't play much, and then there were guys that could play a little and fight, and then there were guys that were hockey players who could fight, and that's how we categorize Reaver. He plays the game. If he has to fight 5 or 6 times a year, he does. But as you know, he makes your team more comfortable and harder to play against.
Being joined by George McPhee. George, last one for you. You referenced Shea Theodore earlier on in the interview. I have him as part of my Norris 5 on my ballot. Just a couple of words from your point of view. I mean, you've been with him every day. He's been a Vegas Golden Knight. Your thoughts on Shea Theodore this season?
Well, he's been terrific for us. He just keeps getting better. And he's not unlike a lot of young guys. It's not an easy league to play in. They come into the league, they're up and down, But when you give them that opportunity and keep them in the lineup consistently, and if they make a mistake, you keep throwing them out there, they learn. And they get to a place where they believe they belong. And now I think Shea is at a place where he knows he's a good player, and he's mm-hmm. playing like it. And Pete DeBoer uses him a little bit different than Turk did. Turk was real balanced in how he used all of our players. And Pete will go to the top guys a little bit more and play them. You know, the defenseman, he'll get 28 minutes rather than 24 or 22. So, and I think the more he plays, the better he is. And, you know, like all the guys, what you like most about him, he's a really humble guy. Just a real good person, real good teammate, just comes from a great family. And we're lucky to have been able to acquire a player like that in expansion, because he's becoming a difference maker.
Listen to more of Hockey Central weekdays from noon to one. This is the best of Sportsnet 590 The Fan.